Hello and welcome to Worlds Apart. The United Nations Security Council has the primary responsibility for the maintenance of international peace and security. So reads the body's description on the UN website. But if we look at the Council's efforts to prevent or resolve major international conflicts over the last two decades, we'll find a very sorry record. Is the Council still earning its keep? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Swaran Singh, Professor of Diplomacy and Disarmament at Jawaharlal Nehru University and a visiting professor at the University of British Columbia. Professor Singh, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me on your program.
Now, Professor, you wrote recently that one lesson taught by the war in Ukraine is that the UN Security Council, as well as other UN bodies, become extremely dysfunctional whenever the conflict involves one or two permanent council members. And that's hardly a new development. I wonder, though, if not having this platform would have been any better.
I think, let me say that UN Security Council is the best that we have at this stage.
And so it's always being said about the UN, but the bill for sustaining those bodies is enormous.
That's right. Let me say, as an academic, the very idea of giving five nations an unusual veto power in UN Security Council was done because of lessons that world has had learned from the League of Nations, which was an earlier model of international organization. The assumption was that if any international organization hurts the core interests of any major power, it may not survive. And that worked. We have five countries having veto power, and the United Nations and Security Council have survived. But have they thrived? Have they really become effective? I think that is the question. And in that sense, we have noticed, and the Ukraine war is only one example, repeatedly, whenever the core interests of any of these five nations get involved, then UN Security Council and other UN organs are no longer effective. Now, that does not mean that we should throw away UN system, because that is what we have at this stage. But this definitely calls for some kind of improvisation, looking for some innovation. And one innovation tried historically has been to go to UN General Assembly to find out what is the world community is thinking on a particular issue if there's a deadlock in UN Security Council. In this case, even the UN General Assembly has not given a clear mandate. So it's a very complex issue, and the UN has proven to be not very effective. And that is why my argument is that, what are the other alternatives?
Can I ask you one more question about the UN Security Council? Because it's traditionally referred to as the P5, which may have reflected the balance of power after the Second World War. But I think right now it's sort of caught between two opposing trends. One of expansion to include more members to reflect the genuine balance of power in the world, and another one of extreme contraction, which I think is exemplified by the American insistence of being the one and only arbiter of international affairs. Which way do you think it's likely to go?
Definitely shrinking it would be counterproductive, because if five are not able to manage, and definitely one or two will not be able to manage at all. So perhaps the only possible innovation is in expansion. And there are multiple suggestions as to how UN Security Council can be more effective by expanding it, whether you want to just simply add some more nations, because the world is no longer the same as it was in 1945. There are new nations that I think are far more capable and influential and acceptable to global community to be put there in UN Security Council. Another suggestion is perhaps not to give veto power to any singular one nation, but to then combine a certain number of nations or regions. And therefore, there is a chance to build a larger consensus as to how that veto gets used. So there are multiple suggestions, but of course, so far it has defied any possibility of such transformation or reformation of UN Security Council. But Ukraine war has again brought that issue up front, that there is need to, you know, sort of reform UN system because it's repeatedly showing fatigue or being ineffective in crises like this.
Now, I don't know if you would agree with me, and let me know if you disagree. But I think one reason for dysfunctionality of the UN system is the formal adherence of the United Nations to the so-called international law and a very practical neglect of that same international law in actual geopolitics. Moreover, I think over the last couple of years, we've seen a sustained effort by Western countries, and more specifically by the United States, to replace international law with the references to the so-called rules-based order, with the rules being set and serving the United States and its allies. Now, as revolting as the Ukrainian war is, and I don't want to minimize it in any sense, isn't it also sort of serving us in exposing this ugly truth, you know, the international system that wants to be seen as polite society, but is ultimately, that is ultimately in reality, very unscrupulous and pretty cynical.
I'm delighted you mentioned the word truth. In geopolitics of major powers contentions, there are often no clear winners and losers. But there is definitely one casualty, and that is truth. Truth is always the casualty of major powers' geopolitical tensions because, you know, everyone has their own interpretations, not just of what is law, but when it comes to more generic term of rule of law, what is that rule of law and who will determine which version of that rule of law is going to be acceptable? That really creates much more confusion in international relations. And when there is a confusion, it is the brute force that comes to use, and which is not a kind of an easy exit from any situation. And therefore, brute force immediately, you know, puts us in a lingering effect where it simply ends in fatigue from both sides and enormous destruction on the ground. And that's not a kind of easy option for anyone to think of choosing. And therefore, I keep saying the only system we have developed, which has more or less delivered in last 75 years, is the United Nations. But there is a need, very urgent need, to reform United Nations system. And that is in its own, you know, on sort of, if UN has to maintain its credibility, it is for its own good that UN system must be reformed to make it more contemporaneous, to make it serve in terms of being representative of the reality on the ground, and also therefore, you know, being more effective in resolving issues and ensuring peace around the world.
Let me ask you one last question about the UN system, which I think after the Second World War has been explicitly based on the notion of balance of power. You know, there are certain members of international community that have nuclear deterrence and that have tried to preserve at least a modicum of this balance during the Cold War. Which side, is it Russia or is it the West, that are trying to change that balance of power when it comes to Ukraine?
The balance of power is never a static formulation, not an equation that is set in stone. It is constantly evolving. And the collapse of former Soviet Union had resulted in an enormous transformation of the balance of power that had existed until that time after Second World War. And there was whole debate about the unipolar movement, which was kind of underlining the U.S. supremacy. But that was contended because, you know, no single nation can be seen as, you know, the most powerful nation. It has to take other nations along. And particularly when you say balance of power, the very connotations, the meaning of power has enormously changed over a period of time. Today we are talking of soft power, sharp power, smart power. You have countries like India. You know, I was avoiding to bring in India here. But India is now world's largest population country with enormous soft power. enormous acceptability around the world, but is not part of the P5 or the permanent five with a veto power in UN Security Council. Whereas you have countries like Britain, which India, even as an economy, just surpassed this year. Indian economy is now larger than that of Britain, but Britain has UN Security Council permanent seat. I'm not saying that Britain should be made to exit or making sure India enters there, but fundamentally, the very power in that balance of power is a constantly changing phenomenon. And that is where we have seen, for example, NATO expanding from 12 to 30, partly also becoming a little more disorganized and multiple voices coming out of NATO again. So that's a constant work in sort of progress. And what we notice here is that the desire in the United States to maintain its assumption of supremacy around the world and whatever powers, are seen as...
Let's specify what you mean by supremacy. Do I understand it correctly as the United States being the ultimate arbiter, the P1, essentially, of the UN Security Council?
There is absolutely no doubt that the American, most Americans, I would say, there are a lot of people in America who also contend such an assertion. But there is a mainstream in the United States that believes that both in terms of being on the frontiers of technology, innovation, being the largest economy, most powerful military, they are the most powerful around the world.
Is that sustainable with the UN vision, the way the United Nations system was created?
United Nations had already created a system where it had put five countries as, equals to decide as to where the world should be going. And when it push comes to shove, United Nations passed it on to UN Security Council. And in UN Security Council, the yes vote of these five was equal. A veto is not different when it comes to United States veto or any other country's veto in UN Security Council. But of course, we have also noticed that in actual practice of UN system, United States and its allied countries like France and Britain have often voted with United States, whether they have voted on their own will or whether there has been certain influence of United States, that remains under debate. But it has appeared over a period of time that United States has increased the asymmetry of these P5. Among the P5, US has really become much more powerful over a period of time. And therefore, it has sought to assert that kind of, exceptionalism of United States, which the legal framework of UN system does not recognize. But the practice of United Nations has become vulnerable to that.
Wouldn't that then change your argument? Because you argue that the UN Security Council becomes dysfunctional whenever any of the P5 members' interests are involved. But it seems from what you're saying right now, it becomes dysfunctional only when the interests of the United States are involved. When the United States doesn't get what it wants, it can sabotage the system. Because from my understanding of the UN record, both China, Russia and even France would be amenable to certain compromises. It's only the United States that insists on its own vision, regardless of the concerns of others.
The veto power of P5 in UN Security Council is legally speaking equal. There is no difference between any of the five when it comes to vetoing. Point is, on what issues they are going to veto it. And sometime in that case, even when immediate core interests of United States may not be involved, for example, United States may not have an existential threat to itself, but it sees its interests as global. And therefore, United States is likely to use veto on several other issues, which it sees as its strategic interests, and not issues that are threatening its very existence. Whereas some other countries, for example, like China, Britain, France, or Russia, perhaps are less likely to use it that extensively. But the validation and the power and the weightage of UN veto power remains the same for all the five. Except, as I said, maybe United States sees need to use that veto power on issues beyond its own existential threat. And there are strategic interests that makes it use that veto. Other powers may have also occasionally used it for their strategic interests. But United States practically perhaps is able to influence the UN system relatively little more than others.
Okay, well, Professor Singh, let me use my veto power on the show and call for a little break, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
Tout d'abord, je voudrais remercier mes abonnés, car on a presque atteint les 200 abonnés.
Je m'appelle Marie, j'ai 22 ans et j'ai 4922 abonnés sur Instagram.
Et du coup, le téléphone est toujours avec vous?
Oui, toujours.
Raphaël, coucou.
Le réseau social est venu amplifier cette idée d'une société où on cherche profondément le bonheur. Il y a cette sorte presque de tyrannie d'un bonheur affiché. L'idée, c'est qu'au fond, le réseau social va venir amplifier, faciliter, peut-être même créer lui-même cette sorte d'algorithme du bonheur dans lequel il faut exister à tout prix.
Évidemment, j'ai envie qu'on m'apprécie sur les réseaux sociaux parce que c'est ce que je recherche. Vraiment qu'on me valide presque.
On a besoin d'être rassuré sur le fait qu'on est aimé, qu'on est reconnu, qu'on est vu, qu'on existe.
Le bonheur numérique est une invention, c'est-à-dire que c'est l'idée que, au fond, l'être humain va mal. Le gros problème, c'est qu'à force de mettre la barre aussi haut, entre autres celle du bonheur, on est sans cesse renvoyé de ne pas arriver à être à la hauteur de ce bonheur.
Back to Worlds Apart with Swarang Singh, professor of diplomacy and disarmament at Jawaharlal Nehru University and also a visiting professor at the University of British Columbia. Now, Professor Singh, as you suggested in one of your articles, with all the dysfunctionality and I would say abuse and manipulation of the UN system, the onus now is on the middle powers to mediate the Ukrainian conflict and possibly some other international upheavals. Why do you think has there been so little progress so far, despite, as we know, some efforts by various leaders to get themselves involved?
Usually, when you say that United Nations system is ineffective and is not delivering to address any crisis, assumption then is that the major powers would try to resolve that crisis outside the UN framework. Now, that obviously has not happened here. And what we are noticing here is indeed escalation of the conflict rather than mitigation or reduction of the violence in any case there. And if that kind of scenario is building, which is very threatening, I remember President Joe Biden in his Warsaw speech mentioned that he has put together a coalition of 50 countries now that are going to support Ukraine. That's not a sign of de-escalation. And I'm sure Russian side is also not willing to relent at this stage. And that is why I say that only option then is perhaps for another category of powers which are much more visible in last decade or so. And these are either called emerging economies or sometimes they're called middle powers. And some of these middle powers have shown a pattern in the United systems voting, whether in the General Assembly or in Security Council, of largely abstaining and not seeking to blame either side. And I think that kind of creates a position of neutrality. And India also calls itself following a position of proactive neutrality, which perhaps creates an opportunity for these countries, and they are mostly countries like Brazil, India, Turkey, I could even include China, that are in communication both with the United States and European powers, but also with Russia and its friends.
Can I ask you, when we talk about these potential mediators, are we indeed talking about nationally driven diplomacy, or rather the personal weight and perhaps dexterity of certain leaders, like, let's say, Turkish President Tayyip Recep Erdogan or Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi? Is it more about national power, or rather the, you know, national leadership?
I think it's a combination of both. It's a national power personified by an influential leader who carries that mandate of that country in taking forward that country's interests at international platforms, but also then being able to perhaps intervene, influence, engage with certain international crises. And that is where, for example, we saw President Erdogan being able to, at some stage, you know, sort of a bargain between Russian sort of powers and Ukrainians and the Western powers. And that was clearly showcased as an example that it is possible for a middle power.
It was engage. Possible until the West intervened and told the Ukrainians to scrap all the agreements. I mean, you know that they actually reached a preliminary agreement there, but it was annulled by the Ukrainian side.
Bulk of the agreements that are signed in international relations are often sort of negated by at least one side later. And so this is not something that should stop any country from pursuing solutions.
But Professor Singh, it's a very crucial argument, because you've seen the American reaction to the recent mediation of China and trying to bring together the Saudis and the Iranians, and the you know, the attitude to that was not very welcoming from the American side. Do you think the United States, which again we've discussed that before, sees itself as the one and only arbiter of what's going on in the world, do you think it would welcome the involvement of genuine involvement and authentic involvement of middle-sized powers? Wouldn't that diminish the American influence?
That's true. There is definitely a temptation in the United States to assert its being the most powerful nation on the planet as of now, but definitely it cannot easily coerce the rest of the international community, and it often tries to take a certain number of friends and allies along. And therefore, it often builds something called a coalition of the willing kind of a network. And so it's not possible for United States to singularly impose its will, even on a smallest nation today, because that's not the kind of world we live in. But yes, given its unusual advantage over other nations, it is often tempted to do that. But here, when it comes to other countries playing a certain role, I don't think United States will be, you know, seen or would like to be seen opposing that kind of initiative, because that is going to be very counterproductive. Because at least at the level of lip service, even United States wants to make sure this conflict comes to an end. Practice may, of course, be different. So if any nation like Turkey, China, India, Brazil, or any other country is trying to engage with this conflict to find its early end or at least mitigation, I don't think United States will be willing to openly discourage that and forget completely opposing it.
Now, speaking about India, it's long served as a major international balancer, but I think since the start of the Russian operation, military operation in Ukraine, and the Western campaigns to ostracize Russia, its value as a partner, its value as an associate has increased dramatically. I wonder how big of a challenge has that been for New Delhi? Do you think it's sort of its positioning of itself on the international stage, did it change in any way due to all the sensibilities and complexities of the Ukrainian crisis?
Clearly, the United States and its friends think that India actually is siding with Russia, which of course is not how India looks at it. India describes its position as position of proactive neutrality, which means engaging both sides to ensure certain kind of dialogue being possible, but at the base also at the same time supplying humanitarian assistance to people who need it on the ground. Now, when it comes to India sort of being effective in that kind of or being affected by the continuation of more than a year long of this war, there is no doubt that the violence continuing this long, which no one in the world anticipated it would, has affected India, because India is absolutely not comfortable with continuation of this kind of violence on the ground. And therefore, India's position over a period of time has changed, I would say. But it does not wish to take either side. It is driven completely by its own sensibilities of what is happening on the ground. And the last expression of Indian Prime Minister during his Samarkand bilateral talk with President Putin, saying that this era is not era of war, and does not come from any compulsion from any outside actor. It comes from India's own civilizational understanding. And I think practically, if you allow me to add, there's a long relationship that India and Russia have had. Russia has stood by India on several difficult occasions, including in the UN Security Council. India is also, an important defense partner with Russia. And these are not considerations that can be simply overlooked because somebody is willing India to say something. And finally, I think it's also important, I think I'm being very selfish when I say that India distancing from Russia under any pressure would be very counterproductive, because that would put Russia much closer to China, which is not something India would like to see. So there are multiple layers and layers of linkages that make India behave in the way India does. But ultimately, the deciding factor as to what India articulates comes from India's own understanding and India's own national interest.
We have only a couple of minutes left, and I would like to ask you about India's role as the leader of the G20. It assumed the leadership of this organization a couple of months ago, which will culminate with the Leaders Summit in September. And you wrote before that India doesn't want the Ukrainian war to hijack its G20 leadership, but it's pretty clear that it's going to be a challenge to bring all those various leaders together, given their striking differences on the Ukrainian conflict. Do you have any ideas, perhaps any intuition about how the Modi government will go about it?
Let me first say that the West was very uncomfortable with India's position, but because India has withstood that, I think there's a greater understanding in United States and Europe of India's position on Ukraine war.
Especially because the United States and the West need India for their own good right now. That's why they can, they have no other choice but to be understanding, because they need India more than India needs them at this point, I think.
I'm happy you are saying that. That brings a certain recognition to India's credentials at international level. As for the G20 presidency, this issue has, of course, rattled the whole negotiations during India's presidency at G20. The finance ministers meeting, the foreign ministers meeting, was not able to come to any consensus final statement because of these two paragraphs related to Ukraine crisis. But look at the positive side. Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, for example, was able to have for the first time a direct conversation with Antony Blinken. That, I think, is an enormous achievement of India's G20 presidency. And Indian Prime Minister is now all set to visit the United States. And I think the attempt here is to make sure that if India during the summit meeting could also make an unprecedented achievement of President Putin and President Joe Biden sitting together, that would be, I think, a great breakthrough when it comes to Ukraine crisis and how to resolve it. Now, whether G20 summit meeting achieves a final consensus document, India would try its best. India is trying its best. That would be a cherry on the cake. But I think as far as Ukraine crisis are concerned, Indian G20 summit meeting, just like the foreign ministers meeting, could see the national leaders of United States and Russia sitting face to face, and even possibility of having a bilateral.
Professor Singh, it's been a great pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much for that.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me on the program.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.
Thank you.